Welcome, everybody, to a keynote lecture as part of the Advocacy Learning Center offered by Praxis and Monavie in partnership with the Office on Violence Against Women. I'm Casey McGee with Praxis. Today's call will be hosted by Shamita Dasgupta. So, Shamita, is that your voice I heard?
Yes.
Welcome, and would you like to begin the call?
Yes. Thank you, Casey. Hello, everyone. I wish you all a very happy, productive, and peaceful 2010. Welcome to the second keynote address. Today is a really good day to learn something new. Today is the festival of the Hindu goddess of learning, Saraswati. So I'm excited about that, and I'm excited that we are going to learn something new from a different field of work. As you already know, the keynote addresses have been designed and incorporated in the curriculum of the Advocacy Learning Center to encourage our thinking and analysis of advocacy. How can we improve our advocacy? How can we sharpen our skills? And how can we make our work more sensitive to the needs of women we work with? That's the goal. Thus, the speakers we have selected for you are not necessarily advocating for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, although they might do so in their own ways, but they are in various other fields of human suffering and human rights work. We can learn strategies and practices from these experts and the work they are doing in their particular areas. It is also a great opportunity for us to establish real connections with them and with their own fields of work. Today, we are fortunate to have Dr. Sayantani Dasgupta with us. She's a medical doctor. She also has a master's degree in public health. She's a professor. She's an advocate for patients' rights in the medical system, a mother, and an award-winning author. Sayantani's work focuses on women's illness narratives, and through women's stories, she teaches healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, health advocates how to empower patients to heal their bodies. The format Sayantani has adopted here, and I believe that she's going to speak for a while, and then we will hear some stories. We will also have an opportunity to react to these stories and ask her questions. So without much more ado, let's hear from Sayantani. Sayantani?
Thank you so much for that generous introduction. I, of course, want to warmly thank Shamita, Sandy, Casey, everyone at Praxis and the Advocacy Learning Center, and all of you who are joining us today, for inviting me to give this address to you. What I'm going to be doing is drawing the connections between the sort of work that I do at the Program in Narrative Medicine at Columbia University with the work that all of you do as advocates. And so what I'll be talking about today, I didn't give the keynote a title per se, but if I were to give a title now, I would say that what I'll be talking about today is about voices and choices. And by voices and choices, I mean the following. Voice, I think, incorporates the notion of power. In other words, who gets heard? In either situations of healthcare or in situations of violence, whose stories count? The notion of power and voice also has to do with us as listeners. Whether we're clinicians or whether we're advocates, we as listeners have a certain degree of power. I'm sure that and here I'll draw from my own field of medicine, I'm sure that everyone out there, although you can't all respond to me right now, has the experience of being in a healthcare provider's office and trying to tell your story and somehow not being heard, right? Someone is taking notes, someone is looking at their computer, not being heard. So that idea of how do we as listeners either use our power over somebody to not hear them, or how do we take account of that power and make space for people's voices to be heard? Do we hear or not hear? Are we present or not? How do we interpret the stories we hear? And if that is voice, if voice has to do with power, then choice is the flip side of that. Choice is the action and advocacy that emerges from the stories we hear. And so today I really will be talking about voices and choices. To back up a little, I am a medical doctor. I also teach in a program called the Program in Narrative Medicine at Columbia University in New York City. And our goal is to honor the central role of story in the medical relationship. And so what we ask in our work is, what do stories do? What do the stories that pass between patients and clinicians do? What is the impact of witnessing a story? What is a witness's responsibility to the story that he or she hears? And what are our expectations of stories based on our own cadre of professional and personal stories? In other words, we all come to the table of listening, to the relationship of listening, with many, many personal and professional stories that influence which stories appeal to us, which stories kind of ring with us, and which stories push our buttons, which stories we have trouble incorporating or hearing. So those are the sorts of questions that we ask in our work. What I'll be doing today is trying to examine those questions, trying to make the connections between those questions and the work of advocacy. And what I'll be drawing on a lot is the field of oral history. Oral history, and I'll speak more about this a bit later in my presentation, oral history is a subspecialty of history. And what oral history does is it thinks about how to hear the voices of marginalized people, or in other words, marginalized stories. It really began at the end of World War II when historians in Germany and France, or in Germany and Italy, were concerned about the common person's experience of Nazism and fascism, because they realized that the story that was on the books was very different than people on the streets' experience. And so this field emerged to hear the marginalized stories, stories that weren't making it to the books, stories that were the stories of kind of individuals who didn't have access to that kind of power, whose voices weren't being heard. So before I really get kind of into the meat of my talk, I'll just leave you with this notion by Alessandro Portelli, the father of oral history, who has said that the storytelling relationship is an experiment in equality. The storytelling relationship is an experiment in equality. And what he means by this is that we as listeners of stories, we as tellers of stories, we will be engaged in a more meaningful relationship if we think about things like the power differences between us, and if we try in many, you know, various ways to make it an egalitarian relationship. So before I get to all of that, before I get to my voices and choices, before I get to oral history and narrative medicine in much more detail, let me back up even more, and let me start today with a little story. This is the story that I'm about to tell all of you, is from a Bengali folktale that my children actually enjoy, and in fact, I like to start with this story in presentations because I actually come to medicine and I come to the work of narrative medicine in many ways via traditional stories. This story comes from a collection of Bengali folk tales that was translated and adapted almost 15 years ago, and I tell the story to frame my comments to you today about voice and choice. Because, of course, folk tales come from a long oral tradition, and in all of our cultures, the ways that stories were transmitted from generation to generation were orally. So anyway, the story I'm about to tell you goes like this. Long, long ago, before things like mirrors were commonplace in homes, there was a magical mirror propped up in the middle of the woods. A poor wandering minstrel came by, and not knowing what a mirror was, he saw his own reflection, and he was overjoyed. "Baba, Baba," he exclaimed, thinking that the image of his own face was that of his dead father, whom he had last seen years ago when his father was the very age that he was now, he was at the moment. So then the minstrel is looking away and, you know, of course, wouldn't you have it, a wandering storyteller comes through the woods and he sees the mirror and, of course, he thinks his reflection is his own dead father, right? And so he exclaims similarly, "Baba, Baba." And then, of course, the minstrel and the storyteller start to argue, right? "It's my father," says one. "No, no, it's my father," says the other. And that's the part that my children think is very funny when they start to argue. And the only way that the two can get out of their, you know, solipsistic rut, right, their self-centered rut, is when they both look in the mirror together. And when they both look in the mirror together, what happens is that the minstrel tells the storyteller, "Oh, it's you." And his, you know, and the storyteller tells the minstrel, "Oh, it's you." And what happens is they can only recognize themselves when they are seen by the other, right? They only know who they themselves are when they are in the other person's presence. And in a sense, the image that they now see is a binocular one, right? Because they aren't only looking into each other's eyes. They're looking in the magic mirror with the other person, and they're seeing a complete picture. The complete picture is both of them together. Okay? And now this seemingly simple story, I think, can be read as a tale about the nature of intersubjectivity. In other words, the nature of two people engaging in something meaningful, like a story, together. And if we think of the mirror kind of as the story that exists between the advocate and the client, then we realize that when either the advocate looks in the mirror alone or the client looks in the mirror alone, there's the possibility there of getting a false picture, right? A self-centered picture. But when we're able to engage in the experience together, there is a state of mutuality, right? And then each person can see him or herself more clearly. In a slightly different formulation, the memoirist Anatole Broyard, who wrote the posthumously published memoir, Intoxicated by My Illness, he wrote, and this is obviously from my field of illness memoirs, Anatole Broyard writes that even as the doctor diagnoses the patient is diagnosing the doctor. And we can imagine them, right? The minstrel and the storyteller, the doctor and the patient, the advocate and the client, gazing together into the mirror of their story or their relationship. So what this folktale gets us to is this notion of witnessing. And witnessing is, of course, just a fancy word, right, for what each of us do every single day, right? Whether we're professional listeners of stories or not, we witness stories each and every day. And what does witnessing entail? Witnessing entails eliciting stories, right? Through either our words, how we ask people to tell us stories, or just our mere presence. Witnessing is not just eliciting stories, but it's receiving stories, right? Am I fully present with my teller, or am I occupied with my computer or my notes, right? Witnessing entails interpreting stories, and most importantly, it entails acting on stories. And if we don't do all the previous parts well, right, the eliciting, the receiving, the interpretation, we, of course, risk our actions, our advocacy, being ineffective, right, because they are potentially then based on our expectations and our stories and our needs rather than those genuinely of the client. And this danger is particularly there, I think, when we are listening to stories that are marginalized, are hard to hear, are different than our own. But that danger, I think, is there with every story that we hear. So how do we, as listeners of stories, be self-critical about our own role as partners in storytelling, not just as passive recipients, but as co-creators of stories. Co-creators, right? And that's an important idea. Witnessing and co-creation, two important ideas I want to get across today. So first and foremost, it might mean that we relook at how we elicit stories. What are the invitations we put out there to individuals when we ask them to tell stories to us? And here, let me draw from, again, my own field of medicine and healthcare and, you know, say, do I come into a room brusquely and ask questions like the following, which I'm sure that many of you have heard in medical settings? Do I ask, you know, in rapid quick fire, how old are you? Have you ever been hospitalized? Have you ever been pregnant? Do you have a heart murmur, high blood pressure, venereal disease, uterine fibroids? Thyroid, diabetes, cancer, do you smoke, drink, use illegal substances? Are you having sexual relations? Right? Do I ask all of those within the course of 2 minutes of meeting someone? And, of course, here I'm, exaggerating for the purposes of my point. But, you know, do I do that? I very well might need to know the information in all of those questions, but is that the most effective way for me to get that information? Or do I think about putting those questions off for later, and asking things that open the door a bit more fully, a bit more creatively, right? I know in your work there may be certain sets of questions that need to get answered, right? We need to know if someone is afraid to go home tonight, right? We need to know if someone's partner has threatened her children ever. But how do we get to those answers? How do we invite those answers in a meaningful way? And here's the critical question, right? It's about the platform we create, the way we approach clients, the way we invite them into a relationship with us so that eventually they can feel comfortable answering those other more difficult questions. So here, let me draw from my own work in healthcare again. And here's where some of my own colleagues in narrative medicine have suggested that maybe the initial question that we invite someone into a relationship with, maybe that question needs to be a bit more ambiguous, a bit more inviting of complexity. I have one colleague who writes about asking the question, and this is, again, in healthcare, tell me about your scars. Right? Tell me about your scars. It's a very open-ended question that allows somebody to get into their life story. I have another colleague who says something like the following. She'll say, I am going to be your physician, and in order for me to serve you well, I need to know certain things about your life and your family and your health. Can you tell me what I need to know? Right? So she asked that question to set the stage as an opening, as an invitation. It doesn't mean she doesn't get to those more pointed questions later. But it's this question of how do we open the door to a real egalitarian or co-authored relationship. And so I'm going to now give you a list of even less directed questions. They are the questions in a story that I'm about to play for you. And I imagine that whether you're in healthcare or in DV advocacy, these might be questions that none of us have ever asked in a professional situation. But listen to them, and we'll listen to them again in the story and talk about them. So here are the questions that we'll hear in the story I'm about to play for you. One, what do you think of today's young people, and have they deteriorated? Two, how does getting married feel? Three, do you think the U.S. is becoming a mess of a country? Four, do you have any mortal enemies? Five, have you ever felt that life is hopeless? Six, are you scared the terrorists might attack? Seven, have you ever lied to a child? Eight, is there anyone you wish were dead? Nine, have you ever thought you couldn't cope? 10, and here's one of my favorites. On a scale of 1 to 10, do you think your life would be different without animals? 11, and finally, why does it seem that everyone loves, you know, your husband or your spouse or your partner more than you or your sibling? So these obviously very irregular questions are some of the questions asked by a 12-year-old boy named Joshua Littman of his mother, Sarah. And the interview I'm about to play is a conversation between 12-year-old Joshua and his mother that was part of an interview that the duo did for the National Oral History Project called StoryCorps. I'm not sure if any of you have heard of StoryCorps. It's Story, C-O-R-P-S, StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a project often that plays its recordings on NPR. Some of you may have heard them that way. It's a project without professionals, except for a sound technician in a recording booth, that allows family and friends and loved ones to interview one another. It is a project that began before 9/11, but that took on a good deal of urgency after 9/11. There was a sound recording booth down at the World Trade Center site, another one at Grand Central Terminal that's still there, and there are multiple sound recording vans that cross the country that ask kind of ordinary folks to tell each other the stories of their lives. And I'm going to use two of these stories today to help us frame our discussion of stories as relationships, not as things, of stories as co-created events. And I'm going to get to some of those ideas after we listen. Because like illness narratives in the healthcare setting, like the narratives heard by domestic violence advocates, these StoryCorps narratives are oral exchanges, right? They are happening right here, right now, in the present moment. And they're born not of solitude, but of community, right? They happen between two individuals. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a bit of this interview. It's about 2 minutes or so long between Joshua and his mother. Pretty clear to hear the mother. I'm just going to caution you and say that 12-year-old Joshua has a British accent, and he also slurs his words a little. So do try to listen carefully. And after the clip is done, I think we might open up the lines for some discussion and reaction before we go on. So here, let me play Joshua's story, and it starts almost right away. So here we go.
Time now for StoryCorps. StoryCorps is the oral history project collecting stories around the country. It gives friends and family members the chance to interview each other about their lives. Today, a conversation between 12-year-old Joshua Littman and his mother, Sarah. Joshua was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism, when he was 5. Soon after, his family moved from their home in England to the U.S. Joshua is now a 7th grade honor student, but he has a tough time socially. His mom, Sarah, describes children with Asperger's as born without social genes. They can come across as eccentric and have obsessions. For Joshua, it's animals. When Joshua and Sarah came to StoryCorps, it was a chance for Joshua to interview his mom. And unlike most participants who rely on questions provided, Joshua created his own.
From a scale of 1 to 10, do you think your life would be different without animals?
I think it would be an 8 without animals, because they add so much pleasure to life.
How else do you think your life would be different without them?
I could do without things like cockroaches and snakes.
Well, I'm okay with snakes as long as they're not venomous or it can constrict you or anything.
Yeah, I'm not a big snake person.
But cockroach is just the insect we love to hate.
Yeah, it really is.
Have you ever felt like life is hopeless?
When I was a teenager, I was very depressed. And I think that can be quite common with teenagers who think a lot, you know, and they're perceptive.
Am I like that?
You were very much like that.
Do you have any mortal enemies?
I would say my worst enemy is sometimes myself, but I don't think I have any mortal enemies.
You don't have a human?
No, I don't. I'm sure probably when I was in middle school, there were people that I felt about the way you feel about him, but to be honest, I don't really remember well enough.
Have you ever lied to me?
I probably have, but I try not to lie to you, even though sometimes the questions you ask make me uncomfortable.
Like when we go on our walk? Some of the questions I might ask.
Yeah, but you know what? I feel it's really special that you and I can have those kinds of talks, even if sometimes I feel myself blushing a little bit.
Have you ever thought you couldn't cope with having a child?
I remember when you were a baby, you had really bad colic, so you would just cry and cry. And
what's
I didn't
colic?
It's when you get this stomach ache and all you do is scream for like 4 hours.
Even louder than Amy does?
You were pretty loud, but Amy's was more high-pitched.
I think it feels like everyone seems to like Amy more, like she's like the perfect little angel.
Well, I can understand why you think that people like Amy more, and I'm not saying it's because of your Asperger's syndrome, but being friendly comes easily to Amy, whereas I think for you it's more difficult. But the people who
like,
take the time to get to know you love you so much.
Like Ben or Eric or Carlos?
Yeah,
and like I have better quality friends but less quantity.
I wouldn't judge the quality, but I think...
I mean, like, first thing is, like, Amy loved Claudia, then she hated Claudia, she loved Claudia,
Part of that's a girl thing, honey. The important thing for you is that you have a few very good friends, and really, that's what you need in life.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations?
You've exceeded my expectations, sweetie, because... You know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also, because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books,
yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you, and it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person. And I'll always thank you for that.
And that helped when Amy was born?
And that helped when Amy was born, but you were just so incredibly special to me. And I'm so lucky to have you as my son.
Okay, so that's, it doesn't matter how many times I listen to that story. I think it's such a fabulous story. So that's Joshua and his mother. And what I'd like to do now is... You know, I'm going to be drawing out some points from the story, but perhaps before I do that, maybe we could just open the phone lines and get a few thoughts. Can we do that? So
no, I have a question, Santoni.
Yes.
If I may ask. Yes. Okay. You know, one of the things that I was thinking is when we go to a doctor, you know, our body is ill. There's something wrong with the body which needs healing. And which, at least the way I have understood it, is a pretty objective task. Here's my body, and it's ill, and I need some medication, or I need something to get it better. In some ways, I think it's a little bit different from, or maybe not, from domestic violence or sexual assault advocacy, because we have to hear what happened to this woman and or what's going on, and you know, we don't want to do something that she doesn't want to do. But the body healing is, I think, is pretty objective, and in that sense, you know, and as a non-medical person, I don't really know what medication would make me better and what would heal me most. Why is my story going to be that important to the decisions the doctor makes or the prescription that she writes?
It's absolutely important. I mean, it's fundamentally important, I think, very much in the same way as it is with domestic violence or sexual assault advocacy. I think that, in fact, so much of that relationship is about storytelling. You know, before there were medications to be given, and here I'm certainly not advocating for going back to, you know, whatever the good old days of medicine was, but the point being, you know, I think traditionally medicine was about getting your story heard. It was about that recognition by a professional of your suffering. And I think that is the common thread between all of these sorts of professions. It's a space to be recognized. It's a space for someone's story and voice and experience to count. And I think that is, in fact, in medicine, I'm not going to put a number on it. You know, I was about to say 50% of healing. But it's a large amount of the healing process is about that recognition. It's about having the space to have your story honored and have your experience count. And your experience then will determine whether or not a professional is giving you, let's say, the medication you really need, is understanding your experience appropriately, is making the diagnosis that needs to get made. And I think that if we don't recognize the notion of voice in medicine or in any of these other professions, we risk making the wrong choices, right? We risk imposing our own, you know, diagnoses, assumptions, stories on somebody else's. We risk making choices that aren't good for them or that perhaps they won't follow through with because it's not what they needed or wanted in the first place. There are huge risks, practical risks, in not listening to stories. And so what I wanted to do with the story of Joshua, you know, I'd still like to get a comment or two about the story, is to tease out, in fact, some of what happens in professional clinical relationships just from this very simple, seemingly unrelated story of a 12-year-old boy and his mother. But does that get to some of the, does that get to the question that you were asking?
Yes, yes. Thank you so much.
Okay, next we do have Friends of Yates. Your line is open.
Hi. You know, we were listening to the story between the young man and his mom, and we were actually, in fact, discussing this, myself and Hattie King is here, and Resmi DePetra, how if, in fact, we don't allow them an arena for feeling comfortable even to tell their story. They might not even tell their story right away. But maybe, you know, working with them and connecting with them to a point where they feel comfortable in telling their story, and then we have to listen and process that in the right way without prejudging them about their story and embracing their story. You know, then maybe they will, you know, open up and allow us to do intervention with, you know, with them.
Absolutely, you know, it's about all of those things that advocacy, in fact, does much better than medicine does, which is things like respect and trust and recognizing that those are two-way streets, and if they don't exist, then none of the advocacy, or for that matter, you know, medication, you know, none of the
action that we do will be meaningful. Absolutely. Thank you for that thought. Is there another thought or two? And, you know, because I'll go ahead and tease out some points I want to make from the story. Did people enjoy the story?
Yes, we actually do have Consejo Counseling. Your line is open.
Great.
Yeah, this is Marisol with Consejo.
Hello. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you guys want my opinion on the story? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was good. I think it's important as an advocate to be able to listen to people's stories when they're talking to you, and I just thought that was a good example. So I don't have very much to say. I'm just listening. Just to get caught off guard.
Well, that's quite all right. Well, thank you for your response. I mean, as you know, to be a bit self-reflective about this experience, right? This is a very challenging kind of listening and mutual, you know, experience in mutuality and listening. In that, you know, I can't see your faces when I normally play this clip, or you know, talk. It's to a room full of bodies and faces that I can read. And as we're listening to the story, we all laugh at certain points. You know, everyone laughs at that on a scale of 1 to 10, would your life be different without animals? And the conversation they have about venomous snakes, right? Everyone laughs. And, you know, people tear up. I still tear up at that point where Joshua asks, you know, am I the son you wanted? Am I the son you expected? Maybe what we'll do is maybe have one more comment, and then I'll go ahead and pull out some more points from the story. Does that sound good, Shamita?
Yes, that's fine. Maybe one more, and then you know, I just want to make sure that you have some time to talk also, and then we can open up for the last the last portion for questions.
Exactly. So what I'll do is maybe have one more comment. I'll go ahead and I'll make some more comments. I'll play another story. And then at the end, maybe what we'll do is open up for some more question and conversation.
Okay. Okay, great. Next, we do have Washington State. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Tira, and I'm in Seattle. And I really love that story. I felt teary, too. It's so profound. So one of the things I was thinking was that I don't know that much about Asperger's, but he has, like, no edits going on, and he's asking all these questions. And sometimes I feel like I'm sitting in a room, and I have, like, these questions, but you can't ask them because you have social constraints that say, oh, you really can't ask if, you know, I actually have asked my mother if I was her favorite child, but it was sort of more in jest. But it was just so interesting to just listen to him just asking all of these questions that were zinging all over the place, and you know, just they're just popping up, and every single question in so many ways is just so profound. And the other thing I was thinking was that that it also made me kind of uncomfortable, like, where is he going with this? And but then to sit patiently and just listen to this thing that is so random and your brain is trying to make some kind of pattern of it, and to listen to his mom who makes this, who's become so wise in the process of raising this son, answering his questions and making sense of it for the rest of us, and just taking away the lesson that to be able to be patient even when the questions and comments and stories seem to be zinging all over the place.
Absolutely. It's a great point, and it has to do with, you know, do you allow the story to kind of unfold, or, you know, do we need to kind of bring it to a point immediately? And we in medicine tend to, you know, we really like to bring it to a point immediately, right?
Well, I think that's true in advocacy, too.
Yeah, you know, the question, you know, how can we go along for the journey, right? And in a sense, you know, we went along for Joshua's journey, but, you know, how do we do that in each and every day of our work?
Thank you for that thought and comment, and thank you all of you maybe who were in queue and didn't have a chance to speak. What I will do is try to incorporate more question and conversation after my comments are through. So if we could shut the lines now, that would be great. And I'll go on. Okay. Are we good to keep going, Shamita?
Yes, please go ahead, and I think the lines are muted now, and we will open it up again and give it more time the next time around.
Perfect. So we will, you know, have more time for conversations. The reason I play this clip is for multiple reasons. You know, here is an interview that's complicated, you know, by the interviewer's age. You know, he's 12. By, as one person just said, Karen, I believe, his Asperger syndrome, right? It's complicated by the fact that he's interviewing his mother, right? But at the same time, it's free from other complications. It's free from the complications of professional distance or a series of scripted questions or any kind of illusions of objectivity, right? He's fully engaged with his questioning. She's fully engaged in giving her answers. And here's the interesting point. He and his mother learn something different about each other and themselves by virtue of having experienced this story together, right? And what is inescapable is this notion that I mentioned before of co-creation, that both individuals who are participating in the story, both a person who's asking the questions, who in this situation is actually Joshua, and his mother, are together creating the story. In a sense, we learn more about Joshua than we do about his mother, right? And I think that that is, in fact, true in medical and advocacy situations as well. Sometimes we learn as much, if not more, about the person asking the questions by virtue of the way they ask, the priority of the questions, right, that they put forth, the way they frame the stories that they're listening to. And the lesson here, of course, is that we all frame the stories we receive. As witnesses, we frame them just by virtue of who we are sitting there in the room, certainly by virtue of our facial expressions and body language, and definitely by virtue of our comments and our questions and our prompts. Because of their close relationship, maybe it's easier for us to hear the mother, Sarah Littman, kind of choosing her words carefully. But we also see that these are the same choices that individual storytellers make. For instance, there's a point, I don't know if you all remember, in the story where he's about to go down, right, that slippery slope of Amy, his sister, again, yet again, right? He's about to ask, say more things about Amy. And the mother almost takes him by the elbow. Like, I can almost see her taking him by the elbow and steering him away from that path. She says, you know, it's not about, you know, the people who know you really love you, right? It's not about quality and quantity, friends. The people who know you really love you, she says. And I think that we'd be kidding ourselves to say that the exact same thing doesn't happen in our professional relationships. That, you know, in my profession, for instance, you know, that a patient with kind of serious repercussions from medicine that they got over the weekend, let's say, might not downplay their symptoms to the doctor that they really love, like the family doctor they really love, because they don't want to burden them. They want to be a good patient, right? So they'll ignore maybe those questions whose answers might be messy or contradictory or too complicated, right? They might steer a questioner away from that area, take them by the elbow and steer them away from that point that they don't want to make. And it happens conversely as well. And I think that this idea of co-authorship takes us back to our folktale, to our musician and storyteller in the beginning. They each have to look in the mirror, right? And according to Alessandro Portelli, the oral historian I quoted before, he says, an interview, but he writes it, and here is where I really regret us all being on the phone, an inter-slash-view. An interview is an exchange between two subjects, literally a mutual sighting. One party cannot really see the other unless the other can see him or her in turn. The two interacting subjects cannot act together unless some kind of mutuality is established. And here he talks about the objective stake that the field researcher or the advocate or the classroom professor or the clinician has in equality. And again, it's this notion of the interview or the story being an experiment in equality. And here I'm not saying that the doctor, equality doesn't mean that suddenly a doctor doesn't become a doctor and throws all their knowledge out the window, or an advocate doesn't become an advocate and doesn't, you know, do something about with the story they listen to or with all the knowledge they have, but rather that we put ourselves in positions where we can be seen and see in turn. So this is my whole kind of idea about co-authorship. And here is another kind of important point I want to make about storytelling today, which is that stories aren't things. They're events. Stories are unique events in time and space. In other words, if I sit down at 1 o'clock with one of you and you tell me a story, the two of us sitting down together at 4 o'clock, we're going to get a slightly different story by virtue of the fact that it's a different time of day. Maybe I'm more hungry. Maybe I'm less hungry. Maybe I know you better now because you've already told me, you know, a previous story before at one. And similarly, I will get a different story from an individual as a colleague of mine walking into the room will. Maybe it won't be a dramatically different story, but it will be a different story. Certain nuances will necessarily be different just by virtue of the fact that stories aren't things. And, you know, this is really this is intuitive in a sense. We all know this in our families, right? The story that one family member tells is always a little different than the story another family member tells of the same situation. But in our professional lives, particularly those of us who are lawyers and doctors and kind of fact finders, we like to think of stories as things. They don't move. They're not dynamic. I tell my medical student, go get me the story. What does that mean? As if, you know, they're Indiana Jones. They're going to go dig up the story and hand it to me, right, on a silver platter. And what the danger of that formulation, the danger of thinking about a story as a thing instead of an event is the following. My medical student goes and gets me a story, and if I think that the story is a thing, here's the danger. When I walk into the room and I get a slightly different story, because of the virtue of my age or my gender or my position or my rank or my ethnicity, what have you, two things are going to happen, two potential things. One, I will walk out of the room and I will say, that medical student is a bad, you know, history taker. They don't have enough experience yet, right? Or, secondly, something else is going to happen. The other option is I'm going to walk out of the room and I'm going to say, you know, that man in room 304, he's a bad historian. And that label of bad historian is so dangerous in medical care, I believe, because what it does is it completely disempowers that individual to continue telling their story, right? Because in the healthcare setting, the moment that we tell our colleagues, oh, that guy's a bad historian, then we stop listening to what they have to say entirely. But if we realize that stories are dynamic, they're going to be slightly different necessarily by the fact of who they're told to, when they're told to them, then we have the opportunity to not think of stories as bad stories or people as bad historians, but rather to recognize that the power of stories is different than, I don't know, the kind of results I might get from an MRI or a blood test or a muscle biopsy, right? It's different. It's not a repository of an unchanging truth, but rather a relationship-making event and a meaning-making process, okay? And I'm going to give you two brief examples here. In his book, The Death of Luigi Trastulli, The Death of Luigi Trastulli is the name of the book, oral historian Alessandro Portelli, who I've been drawing on here quite a lot, he describes many versions of one particular incident. The incident was the killing of an Italian steel worker as the result of a clash with the police. So what happened was there was a strike in a small Italian town. There was a clash with the police, and this particular man, Luigi Trastulli, was killed in the crash. And it was, you know, terrible upheaval kind of in that country and in that area. But what happened was official versions of the event differed dramatically from later eyewitness accounts. And here's the thing. The eyewitness accounts also differed dramatically from one another. And they weren't just little facts. They weren't just, you know, his shirt was red, his shirt was yellow. As seemingly unalterable facts, like the location of Trastulli's death. Oh, yes, I remember. He was shot against the wall. Oh, yes, I remember. He was stabbed in the town square. The chronology of events, even the year of occurrence or the town of occurrence, differed from account to account. Now, how can this be? Either we say, man, those, you know, people from those Italian villages are terrible historians, or we say, huh, you know, the discrepancies don't discredit the validity of these oral sources. Rather, oral sources, and here I'm quoting from Portelli, oral sources are credible but with a different credibility, right? Wrong statements, wrong with quotes, statements are still psychologically true. And this truth may be equally as important as factually reliable accounts. Portelli goes on to say, what is really important is that memory is not a passive depository of facts, but an active process of creation of meaning. Thus, the specific utility of oral sources lies not so much in their ability to preserve the past as in the very changes wrought by memory. These changes reveal the narrator's effort to make sense of the past and give a form to their lives. And I think those of us working in domestic violence, in trauma studies, we know that, right? Traumatic events, they change the nature of the memory. But that doesn't discredit it as much as give it a meaning that's unique, right, to how that describer is describing it. And here I'll give you one more example. Psychiatrist Dori Laub, he is someone who works, he himself is a survivor of a concentration camp, and he's someone who works with Auschwitz survivors. And so Dori Laub describes an elderly Auschwitz survivor recording an interview based on her experiences for the video archive for Holocaust testimonies at Yale. And she's describing the one Jewish armed uprising that happened at Auschwitz. And he writes that she's kind of relating her memories, and she's talking in whispers, and she's a very, you know, elderly, frail lady. And here I'm going to quote from him. He says, all of a sudden intensity, a passion and color were infused into her narrative. She was fully there. All of a sudden, she said, we saw four chimneys go up in flames, exploding. The flames shot to the sky. People were running. It was unbelievable. And so what happens thereafter is that Laub describes how when this video was then viewed at a conference of Holocaust scholars, it inspired an enormous debate about the trustworthiness of the narrative. Because here's the rub. Remember she said she saw four chimneys going up in flames? Historically, on the books, only one and not four chimneys were blown up at Auschwitz. Only one. And this discrepancy suggested that her testimony was therefore entirely untrustworthy. It was utterly important to remain accurate, said Laub, lest the revisionists in history discredit everything. Right? And yet, you know, someone in the group disagrees. And this person makes the point, and I suspect it's Laub himself. The woman was testifying not to the number of chimneys blown up, but to something else, something more radical, something more crucial, the reality of unimaginable occurrence. One chimney being blown up at Auschwitz is as incredible as four. The woman was testifying to an event that broke the compelling frame of Auschwitz, where Jewish armed revolts just didn't happen. She was testifying to the breakage of a framework, and that was her historical truth. So I want to play you one next story from StoryCorps, and I think what I'll do is I'll play the story. It's a difficult story. I'm going to go ahead and make that warning and that caveat. It's a very emotional story about a woman asking her father, who is a Holocaust survivor himself, about his experience in the camps. And what I'm going to do is I'll play the clip. I'll make some points about it. And then maybe what I'll do is open us up for some more discussion. And then before I leave you at 4:30, I'll play one more clip, one more kind of child interviewing his mother clip that has directly to do with DV advocacy. And that's how we'll, you know, spend the next half hour together, if that sounds good. Okay. So I am playing now. This is a story that will actually start right away. I'm playing a story told by Debbie, oh gosh, I'm going to forget her last name, told by a woman named Debbie to her friend. So the clip you're hearing is not Debbie and her father. The clip you're hearing is Debbie telling her friend about interviewing her father. And her father was an Auschwitz survivor. Oh, and here we go. Her name was Debbie Fisher. And this is, again, a story from StoryCorps. So here we go.
You know, while you're doing it, and just give us a, you know, maybe we can just, I can just make a comment here.
Yep.
You know, while I was listening to you, it was, it became so, you know, came vividly to me. We are working with a woman who is at this time, who has been arrested for killing her father.
Oh, sorry, excuse me. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you have it? No?
I do. I have it right now, but go ahead and finish your point.
Okay. I just wanted to say that we are getting into so much trouble because the testimony that she is saying where, you know, this was a very abusive relationship, where she stabbed him, the location, and where the other witnesses are saying he was stabbed is so different that the police just don't believe her. So
yeah,
it's very interesting in that
way. It's the
way.
Same point. It's the Luigi Trastulli
point. Yeah. Okay.
That's
I'm
very
sorry,
interesting.
Just,
no, yeah. Not at all. No, you know, I love that direct tie-in to DV work. That's exactly my point. And again, I'm not saying let's throw out the facts. I'm not saying that a physician doesn't need to know the exact number of somebody's blood pressure. I'm not saying that a lawyer doesn't need to know where somebody was stabbed. But what I'm saying is, if that is our only marker for whether or not we believe individual stories, if that is the only reason we listen to stories, then we're losing a great richness and we are doing, I think, our patients or our clients a huge disservice. So anyway, here we go. Debbie Fisher telling her friend about her father.
Survivor. He had survived the same camp as Elie Wiesel. They were both the same age. And when my dad was alive and through school, I was reading Night. I was 14 years old when I was reading it, but I had no idea that the Auschwitz that Wiesel was writing about, where he lived for a year, was the same one that my father lived in, because my father's Auschwitz was a kinder, gentler Auschwitz. It was sort of like Robin Hood and his merry men meet the Nazis in my father's Auschwitz. There was never a moment where people were dying in front of him. The worst happened the first night, then they killed his siblings and they killed his parents, and then from that moment on, the boys took over, and that was the story we were given. But when he was very, very sick in the hospital and I knew I was losing him, I realized that there was no going back, and that if I didn't make my move, I could not return to the moment of having access to his memories. And this time he was really tired and he wasn't feeling well. And I said, I need to ask you about your time there in Auschwitz. I need to ask you some things, Dad. It's important. And I remember he looked at me, and he had real anger in his face and in his eyes. he said, you know, Debbie, from the time that you were a young girl, you always asked your questions. And I always told you, we got food, we got bread, we divided it up, we didn't suffer. It was fine. And you keep bothering me and asking me the question. And I keep telling you, as if I'm in a room, go away. Stop knocking on the door. I do not want to let you in this room. And yet you keep coming back saying, let me in. And he said, so I'll ask you one more time to go away. And if you knock again, I'll let you in. But if I let you in this room, you will never, ever get out. So do you want to knock again and come in? And I said, yes, I do, Dad. And he was crying. And I remember he had covers on his body because he was really skinny and very, very weak. And he kicked all the covers off as if he was kicking down a door. And he said, fine, come in then. Come into a room that you can never leave. Come in. And then I said, can I ask you my questions? He said, you're in the room. You can ask anything. And I asked him everything that I ever wanted to ask. I asked him to tell me the real story. And he did. It was painful and scary and sickening. I felt a part of me had died. And he's right. Once you're in that room, you can't get out. It's always with you.
So that's Debbie Fisher's story. And usually when I play it in a room of people, we just have to kind of take a moment. Because it's hard to even hear the telling. And we're so many times removed, right? We're hearing her tell about having heard her father tell, who's not even here anymore. And yet it's the power doesn't diminish. And so there's something so terribly powerful about this story of witnessing. And I think, you know, imagining that we're all in a room together, I just want to acknowledge that, that it's a very painful story to hear. And I think that what, and here I'll say one more thing, is that no matter how many times I listen to it, and here, this isn't a dynamic story as such, right? It's tape recorded. But yet, no matter how many times I listen to it, it's different, and it's powerful. Maybe by virtue of the fact that I'm listening to it in with different groups of people, maybe by virtue of the fact that I'm different every time I listen to it, right? But it's different for me, and it's powerful for me every time I hear it. So what I think Debbie's very powerful story does is it tells us both about the nature of witnessing and about the nature of stories themselves. And here, these are going to be my final kind of few points. She creates this notion of not just listening to, but entering into the rooms of suffering with our storytellers. And she has this point of kind of the weight of witnessing, right? Once you're in the room, it stays with you, right? Or as she says, you know, you can never leave. And while that's true, hopefully in the choices we make based on those stories, in the action, hopefully we get ourselves to a place where we're not trapped in the room, right? But, and here is kind of my flipping of Debbie's metaphor. Debbie talks about entering the room of her father's story, right? Her father kind of has that metaphor. She's knocking on the door and entering the room. And here is where I'd like to suggest that maybe entering a story isn't just entering a room. You know, maybe that room has another door that leads to another room, that has another door, right, that leads to another room. And each room is a location in its own right, but, you know, it's never the complete and final and, you know, finished story. Yes, Debbie's father has died, but in a sense, stories themselves are never ending, right? There's always another question that you can ask. Right? There's always one more detail that you can elicit. So maybe stories aren't rooms, but they're rooms to rooms to rooms to rooms, right? They're these mansions of ever-expanding rooms. And I think that, at least in my field, in medicine, this flips on its head,
the idea of what a story is, because we like to think of getting the real story and, you know, we rinse off our hands and it's done. But here, you know, maybe there's no ultimate room we can enter, but we can always ask more, we can always hear more, we can always witness more. Even in Debbie's story, we can imagine that there were pieces of her father's story that he kept to himself, even in death, right? Or there were pieces that he unconsciously couldn't even get to anymore. And so I think the key here is understanding that stories can never end. There's never one final authoritative story, that oral histories can be continued indefinitely. And I think this counters the kind of totalizing impulse of medicine. By totalizing, I mean this impulse that we have to say, now I understand you. I know everything there is to know about you. Finished, right? I don't need to listen to you anymore. We can use it to counter this idea that we get stories, we dissect them for facts, and then that's it, right? And we don't have any role in impacting the way they come out, and we're just kind of blank slates, and we're ultimately objective, right? We in medicine, we like to think of ourselves as really objective. It totally overturns that. And so here, I'm going to quote here from a couple of different folks, from Arthur Frank, who is a writer who writes about illness narratives. He's a sociologist. He says, young professionals are taught that in order to be recognized as a professional, they must utter what they claim to be the last word, the definitive, finalizing word about their patients. And yet dialogue begins with a recognition of the other's unfinalizability. And so what I'll leave you with, and I think I'll open up the phone lines in a moment, and then we'll end again, we'll close the phone lines and then play one last story when we're done. What I'll leave you with is this notion, these notions of witnessing and co-authorship and stories that don't end. And I'll suggest to you that voice and choice is a loop that keeps going back, right? We don't just do things with stories, which we do, absolutely, but the stories also do things to us, right? And the undulation here is between that active knocking on the door in the pursuit of a story and then that place of reception and recognition where the story kind of comes to us and affects us. And so what I think I'll do now is maybe open us up for some longer Q&A, and then I have like a two-minute clip that I want to play right at the end just to kind of leave us with. Does that sound good, Shamita?
Yes, that's
Hello?
Very good. Yes, hi.
Okay, so can we go ahead and kind of open ourselves up again to some conversation or Q&A?
Okay.
Yes.
At this time, to join the question queue, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone at this time now.
Okay. I have a question already on email that came to me, and I want to pose that to you, Santani.
Yes,
This is from Lata from Monsoon, the organization called Monsoon. I wanted to comment about the story, and I'm reading her her writing. I wanted to comment about the StoryCorps segment. The interview was interesting when it becomes non-scripted, especially when Joshua asks about Amy. It shows Joshua's feelings of vulnerability vis-a-vis Amy, his sister. But my major problem with narrative medicine in the U.S. especially is that it is elitist. Healthcare in this country is geared toward those who can pay and pay well. No one wants to spend time listening to an uninsured or a Medicaid patient. On the other hand, it is advocates in community organizations or programs who base their assistance with healing on the stories of people who seek their assistance.
Absolutely. Is there more, Shamita, to the
No, that,
to the email?
That's the comment. And I think what Lata is saying that when narrative medicine is talking about making a relationship, or the doctors making a relationship with the patients and co-authoring, as you point out, co-authoring their story, it's only the which ones they're talking about, not the marginalized voices, not the poor people who are barely getting health care.
Well, and I think that, you know, Leth, I couldn't agree with you more in that, you know, this isn't, you know, kind of a silo. I think that the moment that we have the conversation, not in the context of healthcare, not in the context of power, not in the context of who is getting access to care and who isn't, then it becomes a stilted, much less fruitful, and elitist conversation, absolutely. My hope, and I'm not saying that we're doing it, but my hope and my own work and my own interest is, can this sort of orientation, can this sort of understanding of story be used as a tool of social justice? And how is it that, in fact, these fields which are oriented to hearing the stories that don't get heard, for instance, you know, oral history, which is very much geared toward hearing community-based stories, toward overturning kind of the traditional hierarchies of power and having field researchers kind of enter our communities and receive stories. Are they doing it, you know, can we entirely get to an egalitarian place? No, but can we be conscious of our positions of power and try to actively kind of undermine them or turn them on their heads? Yes, hopefully we can. So the way I approach it absolutely is to think about how can these ideas about co-authorship and power and egalitarianism and about you know, witnessing, how can they be used, in fact, not in the elitist or the silo arena, but how are they, in fact, better tools, better manifest as tools of social justice? So I, you know, really welcome your comment and your critique. I think it's very, very appropriate. And I think that if we're doing it right, then we're always critiquing ourselves and always willing to kind of go to that place where we think about our own power position. So absolutely. Is there another question or comment?
Yes, we do have AICO. Your line is open.
Hi, Phoebe.
Hi. I enjoyed listening to this quite a bit. And I think that one part where that really struck me about was the story of the woman who said that it was kind of candy-coated, the story of Auschwitz, where it was like this Disneyland, and then when she heard the real story, she was changed forever.
Yeah.
I think that really struck me as where you hear people or women who are homeless or, you know, in some way traumatized or raped or anything. It's kind of like it's if you use the word raped, it's almost sexualized or something, you know, like I just found it to be where it took another way to look at it in order to address that this is how, not quite sure how to say it, but or the best way to say it, but it's something such a horrible place, such as Auschwitz, and how the father felt that to protect the daughter, that it was this story of this candy-coated place. And that's all I really have to say.
No, thank you for your comment. And, you know, of course, the complication there is, you know, is she enacting violence? You know, I mean, this is the real question. It, you know, she talks about battering down the door, you know, almost like she's knocking on the door. And, you know, sure, I mean, I think I would make the case that this is her father, therefore this is also her story, this is her family legacy, this is her family history. And so it's a different sort of a relationship than if she were, you know, an advocate, if she were, you know, a clinician of some sort, or in a professional relationship with him. But, you know, that's the real question is he's not wanting to tell her. And she's banging and banging on the door. And, you know, is that an enactment of violence or not? You know, so that I think is a real tension also in that story that relates to this notion of, you know, the candy-coated story was the one that he felt comfortable telling at that point. So how do we figure out, you know, how much to knock on the door and how much to not? And I think that's an ever-moving target, and that's another kind of tricky place to think about. But thank you for your comment. Do we have other comments or thoughts or questions?
Yes, we do. And next we do have the Battered Women's Project. Your line is open.
I think that it goes back to, I'd have to agree with the same story that struck me was the one of the woman talking about her father and the vicarious trauma that she experienced by knowing the truth. And I think that it would be more so when you hear it from a family member than when you hear it from someone that you don't have that intimate relationship with.
Absolutely. Although, you know, as we all know,
mm-hmm.
you know, those of us who work, listening to
mm-hmm.
Survivor stories, be they of, people who are, survivors of all sorts of violence or
mm-hmm.
all sorts of suffering,
mm-hmm.
There's, vicarious trauma there. And so what do we do with that?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we not let it immobilize our work, or how do we not let it burn us out, right? How do we get to a place where it's affecting us but not
mm-hmm.
destroying us? And what does that mean? I think these are all really tricky questions that I'm sure we all struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I come from a profession where we tend to, or traditionally, there's this, foolhardy notion of distance and objectivity, which, is never real. But that's the idea, that that's how
mm-hmm.
people don't get burned out. But that's, of course, not true either.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for your reaction and your thoughts. Are there other folks who want to make questions or take the conversation in other directions or react to something that was said or ask for clarification?
Yes, we do have Lamano. Your line is open.
We're just discussing it and kind of trying to relate some of the stories to the work that we do. And, mostly is, yes, listening and actually taking to count the and working on the resources, so doing much more than listening and assisting.
I'm sorry, say it again. I didn't catch the last bit of what you said.
I was going to say, sometimes we have to do more than just listen. We have to also, in our heads, think of all the resources and provide the resources that they need and just not, just listen to stories, but also problem solve as we're listening to be more effective in the work that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the question is, are we, the question from this sort of a perspective, hopefully, is, are we problem solving, effectively? Are we problem solving based on, really kind of what their, what's an individual stated need is, or, are we coming from a place of empowerment? What I'll do is there's a great story that gets to this point that maybe some of you will be interested in just, having for your own uses, or maybe some of you will be interested in using it with teaching. Maybe I'll send it through Sandy if somebody's interested, and I can send other references as well through Sandy. It's a great story by Julia Alvarez. I don't know if people are familiar with it. It's from her collection Yo, which is her sequel to How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. And it's a story called The Stranger. And I'll give you a real two-minute quickie on what the story is about. It's about this woman Yolanda, who's the protagonist, goes to her uncle's kind of wealthy uncle's house in the Dominican Republic, and there's a housekeeper who's working there who can't read and write and wants her to write a letter for her, to her daughter who lives in America. And the backstory that Yo doesn't know about is that this woman's child, a number of years ago, drowned in the uncle's kind of pool, which is obviously, a symbol of kind of his wealth. And the symbol of her kind of inability to make other choices is, of course, the fact that she still, has continued to work for this uncle. And as the story goes on, she's dictating a letter to her daughter, and her daughter's obviously experiencing violence, and she's kind of urging her daughter to make certain choices, to, you know, stay with, you know, hopefully the violence will get better, stay with him. And in the process of transcribing the letter, Yo kind of gets to a place where she is saying, well, no, that's, you don't mean to say that. You mean to say you're really proud of her for standing up for herself, right? And the woman says, "See, Senora, you know, that must mean what I mean. You would know better than me." And it kind of goes on like that. And it's, you know, it's the story is problematic in certain ways. I'm not sure that, you know, it's a totally unassailable story, but I think it's a really interesting story that gets to some of these points that we've been talking about, these points of when it is really important to think about story as a partner of action, that, you know, Yo, I think, in the story, thinks that she's doing wonderful things, but in the end, she is enacting violence kind of in the same way by silencing this already very silenced woman's story, and not listening to her and kind of putting her own story kind of all over, right, her letter. So it's an interesting story to kind of play with some of these ideas, and I'm happy to send it along through Sandy.
That would be great if you can just send it to me or this is Shamita. Me or Sandy and Sandy, and then we can send it out to the listeners today.
That sounds wonderful. Today. That sounds wonderful if people are interested. Are there other questions or thoughts?
Hi, Tani. This is Amanda.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Hi. So I have a comment or a question, and it's sort of a mixture. What strikes me about listening, you know, to the Auschwitz story and the young woman asking her father for the story is what it makes me think about is the apart from finding incredibly upsetting is and you know it made me upset, and then I'm thinking about how upset I get about what happens to women, and I think that the cultural climate in which we talk about what happens to women is significantly different than the cultural climate in which the Holocaust is talked about. And with a few exceptions, the Holocaust is acknowledged for what it was and what it did to people. And I think that the extent and the prevalence and the horror of violence against women is not acknowledged in globally. It's not acknowledged here, and it's not acknowledged in the world yet. And what it makes me think of is the difference in hearing a story in a certain context. So, for example, in a cultural context, and I mean that in its broadest sense. So when the stories of Auschwitz are told now, they are listened and heard in a different context than the stories that we're hearing from women. So when I see an advocate sitting in a room listening to women, woman after woman after woman after woman who's telling stories of rape and sexual assault, just taking that issue alone, the cultural context in which we're doing that is that it's almost like there's this whole backdrop that is in denial about that. So the advocate is in the middle of the stories that they're hearing over and over and over and over again, the testimony that they're witnessing. And then they're in between that and this cultural backdrop of denial about it. And then I think that a coping mechanism that advocates therefore have to have is to, I think one of our coping mechanisms has to be to psychologize it.
Yeah.
For example, someone earlier mentioned this term vicarious trauma. I don't think that's, When we listen to the woman talking about her father and his story, mostly what we do is not use terms like that. We stand back and we say, it is horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrific what happened, and there are no words to explain it. We just sit back and we accept the horror of it and say it should never happen again. But somehow, with violence against women, we have a string of, you know, whatever, pathologies and explanations and this and that and this and that and this and the next thing that we dump on it and we dump on her. And I think it's because we're in this culture where there is overall a denial about the extent to which we have multiple Holocausts going on globally right now in terms of women's position in the world.
Amen. Hear, hear. I think that, you know, it similarly, I think a similar, and again, this is not to draw, you know, obviously comparisons are horrendous. I'm not trying to say that this is the same example, but it's, I think, similar to when we see kind of bodies of color suffering at a distance, right? We see, you know, kind of these terrible, you know, commercials of, you know, children in some distant land suffering and, you know, children of color. And there is this assumption that it's going to go on. There is a culture of acceptance. And absolutely, so the cultural platform in which we hear something so impacts, you know, the way we hear it. And I think that, you know, there's distancing that happens when, you know, it's happening over there, and they're silencing when it's happening here. But it's the same effect, which is some stories have the cultural, permission to be heard, or the cultural platform to be heard, and others don't. And I think your point about how do we kind of lessen the horror or make room for the horror is. You know, maybe through mechanisms like distancing or mechanisms like psychologizing. I think it's a very interesting point.
I just wanted to say that I know that, Anthony, you had another small excerpt to play, but
yeah, what I can do is I can forward it if there's,
yes,
you know, because
yeah,
I am mindful of the fact that it's 4:30, so I can go ahead and forward it along with Julia Alvarez story to
that'd
folks.
That'd be wonderful. And I just wanted to say that this has been very, very fascinating to listen to you and to know what is happening in the field of narrative medicine and the connections that we have and the similarities that we have between the two, you know, violence against women and narrative medicine work that is going on. We really, I think what I've been listening is that in narrative medicine, the work that is going on is trying to place women's voices and choices at the center, and that is exactly what we as advocates are trying to do. In the core activities that are there in the curriculum of Advocacy Learning Center, it highlights almost everything that you've talked about today, the connection, the understanding, the examination, the strategizing, you know, how do we do, what kind of action we take, and implementation, and assessment, going back again and reviewing and changing. So it's amazing. It's telling women's stories an act of empowerment by itself. And when women tell their stories and people listen, we are acknowledging its truth. And it's really a step towards changing society. When society hears these stories and they validate the stories, the society is changing itself. So thank you, Santani, for this wonderful, wonderful talk. And it is absolutely fascinating and enlightening. And I just want to say also thank you to all the participants for joining us for this second keynote address. And I think the third call is scheduled for April 14th.
Yes.
And we have another exciting speaker for you.
Yeah.
And Casey, you might want to
just say a couple things.
Yes, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Santani and Samita, both so much for your thoughts and your work today. And thanks also for all of you for joining us and your thoughtful comments and questions. And then looking ahead, as Samita just did, on February 9th, there will be an audio conference training for advocates, and we'll cover problem-solving, critical thinking, openness, and creativity. Should be fun. And on February 11th, there's an audio conference training for managers, and we'll discuss maintaining organizational sustainability. So with that, I'll wrap us up. Thank you, everybody, and have a very good afternoon.
Thank you all very much. Thank you for having me.